Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Joan Frank. I'm the author of 6 books of literary fiction and a book of collected essays about the writing life. Small pause for my own trumpeting. This is my new novel. It's called All the News I Need. It's going to be available at every bookseller today and any bookstore you love, especially indie booksellers. I hope you'll go look for it, and I hope today you'll look for the books of my wonderful panelists. First, some announcements. Please take a minute to turn off your devices, your cell phones, as a matter of courtesy, and thank you for that. We'll go about an hour, and we'll ask for audience questions at the end if you have any. I have sponsors to thank for this panel. I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, please forgive me if I don't. The Barbro Osher Suecia Foundation, the Consulate General of Switzerland in San Francisco, Culture Ireland, FILI, which stands for Finnish Literature Exchange, Finlandia Foundation National, Pro Helvecia, the Consulate General of Mexico in San Francisco, and the state of Jalisco. After we speak, we'll all be signing our books just outside in the patio there. Please come and have us sign for you. And I think that's it for the general announcements. I'm going to introduce my wonderful panelists now. I'm so happy to meet with them. We've been in touch by email for a few weeks before this, and I feel like we've made a secret club, of which I'm president and sergeant-at-arms. Their books have respectively made big splashes on both sides of our Atlantic pond. Oh, Jonas, is it Lusher?
Yeah.
Lusher, okay. In no particular order. This is Jonas Lusher, whose novel Barbarian Spring won the Bavarian Art Prize and was shortlisted for the Swiss Book Prize and longlisted for the German Book Prize. His background is astonishingly Renaissance man-like, with involvement in film, economics, philosophy, and editing. He is now writing political essays and opinion pieces for newspapers, mostly about refugee politics, social justice, and social welfare, and travels a lot with Barbarian Spring, which has been translated into 16 languages. Jonas published his second book in January, a novel called Craft, which is being brought out in English by the fabulous Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I told Jonas that a lot of authors would sell a body part in order to be published with FSG. Paitim Statovci is the author of the novel My Cat Yugoslavia, which won Finland's highest literary honor for best debut novel, the Helsingin Sanomat Literature Prize. It has since received rave reviews from the New York Times, The Atlantic, Slate, and a pile of other distinguished venues. The novel has so far been translated into 11 languages. He is presently working toward master's degrees in comparative lit at the University of Helsinki and in screenwriting at Aalto University School of Arts, Design, and Architecture. Colin Barrett was born in 1982 and grew up in County Mayo, Ireland. In 2009, he was awarded the Penguin Ireland Prize. His 2015 story collection, Young Skins, won the prestigious Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, the Guardian First Book Award, and the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature. It also received hearty praise from some of the biggest writing guns around, including Anne Enright, Colm Tóibín, David Means, Colm McCann, Sam Lipsyte, and Kevin Barry. Aura Zilonen, am I saying that right, my dear?
Shilonen,
thank you, is a novelist and filmmaker from Puebla, Mexico. She was born in Mexico City and spent her childhood in Germany. Her debut novel, The Gringo Champion, completed at the age of 19, won the 2015 Premio Mauricio Achar and received rave reviews in the New York Times Book Review, Booklist, El Sur, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. I have read these authors' books, And they are electrifying. Encountering their work for me has really and truly been a gift and a revelation. And I urge you all to get hold of every single one. Okay, I'm going to ask them all a bunch of questions, and I'm going to encourage them to provoke each other with responses. And then if there's time, I'll ask each of them individually a particular question aimed at that person. And then if there's time, we'll ask for audience questions. So because this is a panel about beginnings, I'm going to try to remember to go back to beginnings, to begin and end with beginnings. And so I'm going to ask each of them very briefly, to read a paragraph or two from their work so you, the audience, can get a little taste of how they sound, how they read, very briefly. Who would like to go? Colin, want to start?
Sure, yeah.
Sorry. Not to blindside you.
No worries, John, that's great. So I'll just read the couple of opening paragraphs of literally the first page of the first story in the collection called The Clancy Kid. My town is nowhere you've been, but you know its ilk. A roundabout off a national road, an industrial estate, a five-screen cineplex, a century of pubs packed inside the square mile of the town's limits. The Atlantic is near. The gnarled jawbone of the coastline with its gull-infested promontories is near. Summer evenings and in the manure-scented pastures of the satellite parishes, the Zen bovines lift their heads to contemplate the V8 howls of the boy racers tearing through the back lanes. I am young and the young do not number many here, but it's fair to say we have the run of the place. It is Sunday, the weekend, that three-day festival of attrition is done. Sunday is the day of purgation and redress, of tenderized brain cases and seesawing stomachs and hollow pledges to never ever get that twisted again. A day you are happy to see slip by before it ever really gets going. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. Jonas.
It was the English teacher Pippa Grayling then who initiated praising into the social standing of the various guests at the desert resort. When he recounted it to me, he tossed in an apposite quotation from Anna Karenina, which summarized the social hierarchy in that little German spa where the Shchebatskys go for a rescue. What really made Pippa and praising click straight away was the fact that they were both at 1001 Nights under duress. She was here because her son had decided to hold his wedding at the Tunisian Oasis Resort, flying in no fewer than 70 friends and family members. That, Pippa explained, making no attempt to hide her irritation, was what a young couple who both worked in the city imagined passed for a society wedding. Her son Mark and his bride-to-be Kelly formed the nucleus of that large group whom praising had already seen gathered around the pool. Young people in their late 20s or early 30s, brash and self-confident, trim and gym-toned. The men sported sand-colored chinos, polo shirts and moccasins, and the women tank tops and figure-hugging shorts over gold-tanned, silky, smooth legs, flip-flops on their dainty, manicured feet. Those who'd opted for a dip in the pool were wearing the kind of swimming trunks familiar from old photos of JFK on the beach at Martha's Vineyard, or skimpy bikinis that showed off flat stomachs to the best effect and justified the Brazilian they had done before coming away. Even in this state of near nakedness, though, they all looked like they were in uniform. Praising kept running into little knots of them all over the complex. He'd encounter them standing around one of the bars, cracking jokes or disappearing, snogging furiously and groping each other under the waistbands of their tight shorts into their climate-controlled tents, or ordering the stuff around imperiously and stomping their way through the palm grove, cursing as they searched for better reception for their Blackberries.
Thanks, thank you. Jonas. Pai Ting.
So I will be reading a short chapter where I'll just read. When people ask me my name, I sometimes give them an honest answer, but just as often I say it's Michael or John, Albert or Henry, because that way I avoid the next question, which is, where are you from? I always wonder why people want to know that. Are they asking me because they are genuinely interested in my home country or in order to make judgments about me? Because it's one thing to tell someone you are Swedish, German, or English, and quite another thing to say you are Turkish or Iranian. It's only very rarely that someone's home country is of no significance at all. When I invite people to my apartment, they generally accept because they are fascinated by the fact that I own a snake. They take off their shoes, step inside, and see the terrarium with no snake inside it. Oh. When I tell them it's probably under the sofa, they stop at the living room door and ask why I decided to have an animal like this as a pet. Before answering, I always have to correct them. This isn't any old snake. This is a boa constrictor. On a few occasions, I've told them the truth and said, I don't know because I'm actually afraid of snakes. Still, most of the time, I simply say that I got it because I know a lot about snakes, because they are calm creatures, suitably independent, and don't need much looking after. A snake is the perfect pet for someone living alone. When I start pulling it out from under the sofa, my guests suddenly need to go to the toilet. And when they come back, they have to leave. They back off and start putting on their coats. It's too big and terrifying as I wrap the length of its body around my shoulders, and its skin isn't slimy as they thought, but dry like soft plastic, like shining silicone. A giant thing like that. Wow, they gasp as they open the door. Aren't you afraid? What if it gets into the toilet and slithers down the drain? They close the door after them, and I wonder why they ask things like that about the snake. It could just as well learn to moisten its skin in the toilet bowl and slither out again, or learn to do its business there just like everybody else. Is it really the case, I wonder, as I stroke its coarse head, that people expect the worst of it simply because it is a snake?
Thank you. Thank you, Pike. Aura.
Hello, thank you for coming. And I want to say, excuse me by my pronunciation, because this is the first time that I am speaking English in front of people. So, yeah, but I am here with great courage and trembling a little bit. So I want to read a little part in Spanish and then the same part in English, so you can imagine the exciting and everything with the English part, because I don't know what will happen. So, yeah. Y entonces se me ocurre, mientras los camejanes persiguen a la chivata hermosa para bullearla y chiflarle cosas sucias, que yo pueda alcanzar otra vida al putearme a todos esos meridianos. Al fin, nací muerto y no tengo ni pizca de miedo. Lo pude comprobar desde siempre, como hace rato, cuando le molí todos los dientes a un camejón que le tiró un perro a la chivata. Y ella, sin decirle nada, solo miraba la calle por donde debía venir el bus. Y ella toda incómoda, y más cuando el putarraco le tentonichó una nalga con sus dedos infestados de espronceda. Ahí rompí los lazos que mataban al mostrador de la book donde trabajo. Sentí vibrar el polvo a mi alrededor y salí disparado para madrearme los puños a su jeta. Total, ¿qué podía perder si nunca he tenido nada? So, yeah. Alright. And then it hits me. As the screws tried the gorgeous chickadee, hotting at her talking dirty, that I can get myself another life by beating these pinches Australians up. After all, I was born dead already and nothing fucking scares me. I could always prove it, like I did a while back when I smashed it in the teeth of a Scrooge who was making moves on the chickadee while she, silent, just started down to the street toward where the bus was supposed to be coming. It's.
That's fine. Thank you, Aura. Thank you. That was vivid. I'm so glad they read, because you can get a feeling for them and themselves as well as their work, and it's delicious. I have to say, it's a privilege to be in this position, because to have been caused to read their work, I am, as an older writer, heartened by the carrying forward of the torch of serious literary endeavor by the young and brilliantly. It sharpens one's game, and it gives one a lot of hope. So, starting with the beginnings, which is what this panel is ostensibly about, I'm going to ask each of them, in just a brief summary, how the particular book in question began. And I ask it with a sense of knowing that for a lot of writers, the thing you start, you don't really know what it is when you start, but it starts to tell you what it wants to be as you go. So I'll just go right down the line. Colin, throw a few words at that.
Sure. Young Skins is a collection of short stories. And
did you know that they were going to be a collection, or was it just one story followed blindly by another?
Well, when I started writing stories, it was definitely just one story at a time, and it took years to finish any story, So then you eventually do that, and it's not very good. But then you move on to the next one, and I've been writing since I'd wanted to be a writer since I was in my late teens or whatever, really, and I spent years trying to write poetry and attempting a few novels. And then I came to short story writing maybe in my mid-20s, and just through discovering writers. And, I was at the time I was working in an office full-time, and so I was just kind of, reading really good short story writers in my spare time. And it was the form that really just helped me, it certainly helped me develop as a writer, whatever my temperament or my abilities seemed to be amenable to writing in the short story form. And really the practicalities of this book coming about was due to my Irish publisher, the Sting and Fly Press, which is a small, just about one man operation running out of Ireland. And
what's the name of the press?
Stinging Fly
Press. Stinging Fly. Okay.
A fly that stings.
Okay.
And the man who runs it, Declan Meade, it's a literary journal. It originally started as a literary magazine, publishing new Irish, looking for new Irish writers. It's been going, but I think it's the longest literary magazine that's ever been running in Ireland. It's been going 25 years now. And he started publishing collections. Which is not the most commercially viable proposition. Most publishers will, grimace when you say I have a book of short stories under my wing. They're like, okay, great. Because they don't sell it, that's fine. But I mean, so he's it's a labor of love for him, and he published me in the magazine, basically just plucked me off the, slush pile, really. And read one story, asked me to send him another, and then just he just worked with me on it for years. He kind of said, well, when you've enough for a collection that are good, I will put it out. And he told me that maybe 3 years before it got published. So
he sounds like an angel.
It's a very rare experience, and the man puts everything into it, and he's very rare even in publishing. But
let us now praise that man's name.
So Declan was instrumental. I mean, he encouraged me, and he said, keep going with the stories, that really helped. The only other thing, I suppose, the thing in terms of writing this collection specifically was it's set in a fictional West of Ireland town, a rural town, provincial town on the coast. And it's fictional, but it's drawn from, I grew up in a town like that. And that really helped the stories as well. That helped focus them once I realized I'm writing this, but I've set them all in this town. And that really just helped, again, that helped focus the stories, it helped energize my writing. So that was the other gift in terms of, insofar as, as you said, you don't know where you're going with the story, but I knew I had a setting and I knew the place to write about.
Got it, thank you. And Jonas, how did you begin? How did Barbarian Spring begin?
I would say, The thing is that this is not my first book. I have written an extensive novel before, which I never published, but I worked on it like 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
So after that, not finding a publisher for it, I didn't have the courage to start with another long novel, for which will take me another 6 years or something like this. So I decided to write a novella. Barbarian Spring is a classic novella, not a novel, which is in Germany quite an important and very traditional form. Mm-hmm. It has certain rules defined by Goethe and things like this. So I decided to write this novella, so I knew it will take me only 3 years or something like this.
Smart.
Yeah.
And yes, novellas.
And actually my first idea was to write a novella with the main character who never acts by its own or makes any decision. So I have a main character. It was like an experimental setting for me. Can I write a novella with a main character who never makes a single decision in the whole book? In some really big stuff, like he can't decide if he wants to get rid of child labor in his factory, but he also can't decide if he wants to go to dinner with his button shirt. Yeah. So that was kind of the beginning.
A great challenge.
And in Goethe's novella theory, every novella has to have something he calls an almost unbelievable thing happening. And I was thinking, what could it be? And in my case, it's the financial bankruptcy of Great Britain and the collapse of the financial system, which I choose because during this time I was also working on my PhD in philosophy, and it was mostly about narratives about the financial crisis, and I worked a lot about economic topics in science.
Thank you. Excellent background deepening. Pai Tim.
Yes, so... my story is a cliche, actually, because I've always read and I've always known that I want to be a writer. And in my early 20s, I was studying literature at the University of Helsinki and working in a supermarket simultaneously. And one night, I just asked myself that since I know that I want to be a writer, what's stopping me for studying tonight? So after that shift, I went home and started writing this
my God,
this book, and and then 2 years later I had a manuscript, and then I just sent it out, and I never imagined that it would take me like around the world. But
that is a Cinderella story.
Yeah, sometimes these things happen.
Yes,
I guess.
Remarkable and heartening. Okay, thank you. And Aura.
You were
16.
Yeah.
You were 16 years old. Holy crap.
Well, I always wanted to be a filmmaker, but cinema is very expensive in Mexico and here, of course. So I understand that the best way to do a filmmaker is writing, because in the right you can do anything, and it is not expensive. So yeah, and when I was 16, my grandfather got sick, so he had hemiplegic and diabetes. Mm-hmm. So he was like my father, because we,
you were close.
Yeah, so close. So he started to telling me so many stories about his joyful?
His youth.
Youth?
Yes.
Yeah.
Child. Yes.
So I was thinking that will be a shame if these stories get lost with the years. So I start to writing these stories, and I was asking my family what my grandfather told you, or... Mm-hmm. And that's how began this book. But in the end, The Gringo Champion, it's... more, it's 90% fiction, and only a few parts are real for my grandfather. And yeah, that's how.
That's Likewise, amazing. Completely amazing. How much did any formal writing training come into? I'll start with you again, Aura. Did you go to any school for it or take class?
Yeah, but I, like you said, I live in Germany almost 2 years, but that was because we went for tourists to visit my aunt who was who get married with a German guy. So, but my brother, who had 8 years old, he lost the passports, the tickets, all the documents. So we didn't have the money to return to Mexico. And my mom says, like, okay, we are fine here. We can stay here. And we were child. I was 6 years old or something.
Oh my goodness.
And we spent there almost 2 years. And my aunt put us like little jobs for chill, for child's jobs. So one of that job was writing 1,000 words every day in letters for my Mexican family. So that's how it started, by obligation, but then it
evolved.
Yeah. And when I returned to Mexico, I wanted to keep writing. So I did it because I love to write. And in Mexico, I had an uncle who is a teacher of dramaturgia.
Drama.
Yeah. So he lives in my house, and why I need to go to pay for his classes if I can ask them.
Fantastic.
Ask him. And that's why I had this all these years a very personal teaching.
This wonderful story. Thank you.
Yeah.
Paiteam, did you take formal class when you began that night of supermarket day job?
Yeah, I didn't. But I feel like I've been reading a lot since I was very young, and I don't. That's a sort of training too, because you're in constant dialogue with other stories and
of
the
course.
Language, and I don't know.
Yeah, but that's the richest soil, I think, is if you're reading from the very beginning. So, okay. And Jonas, you took so many classes, I don't know where to begin.
But no writing class.
But not writing?
No, not at all.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it's actually in Germany, teaching creative writing or taking creative writing classes is something rather new. It started like maybe 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And in all German world, you have like serious universities giving writing classes. You have like four of them in Switzerland, Austria, and Germany together.
My goodness.
It's kind of unusual. For a long time in Germany, there was the opinion that writing is something you can't teach. It's still very... People who take this teaching class, these writing classes, they have to fight with a lot of prejudice,
mm-hmm.
That they all write the same and that they are kind of not really artists because it's just learned and not from their self or something.
I see.
Like this. Yeah, there's a certain...
Interesting. So in a way you overcame that just by going ahead with it.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Colin.
Yeah, I mean, I did actually go and do a master's in creative writing, which was a one-year course in University College Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the thing was I did do it. I'd graduated from like art college as an undergrad. I'd done English at like the age of 21, and then I worked for full time for like 5 years in an office job for Vodafone. I worked in a call center, and then the Celtic Tiger, so they promoted me up to like quality control. So you're kind of like the Stasi, you're listening in on the employees and sort of creating them. You know, but so I eventually, like I needed a reason to quit my job and go back and write, or you know, try and write more seriously. I was writing the whole time doing that, and you know, I basically needed to go and like tell my parents and tell whoever else I'm not just quitting this job and sitting in my apartment on my own for, you know, writing a book. I'm going back to college.
Right.
And a little bit like Jonas said, creative writing courses are now very popular, and they're in every, you know, college in Ireland. But again, I'm 35, and I finished at 21, so that's around 2001 or two, something like that. I graduated initially. There was no creative writing courses in college at that point as well. So even then, there was one in Trinity College, mm-hmm. had been running one for like five or six years at that point. That was it. There's no UCD didn't offer one at any level. So, you know, it wasn't really that, you know, it wasn't something I was like dying to do or believed that was something you had to do, which I think a lot of people feel. Maybe I have to get a formal qualification in, which of course you don't. No editor, agent, they don't really care. If they don't like your writing, the fact that you've got a master's isn't going to help.
Right.
So it's not really a boon in that sense.
Did people give you grief when you announced your intention?
Most people didn't care either way. Okay. They were like, fine.
That's fair too.
But I mean, I enjoyed the year. It was a year to write full time, and I kind of developed a bit of stamina, you know, to be able to kind of, you know, try and write every day. It's really, you know, it's hard, and you can only do it really in little bursts, and even still I only can, but it helped a little, and it gave me structure, it gave me an alibi as to, you know, it gave the appearance of momentum and direction in my life.
Productivity.
I mean, I finished that course, and it was 4 years before the book got published, and I was mostly unemployed back in the room, like I said, I wasn't going to be.
Wow.
So that, I mean, that's when I wrote all the book, really, so, yeah.
Oof. Okay, this one's tricky. The question has been suggested to me by a fellow writer. Has a political climate or political events been something you felt aware of while you wrote? Incidentally, I guess I better just stop the proceedings right now and first apologize for the United States in every way. And secondly, apologize. My husband is from the north of England, the slimy, blighted north, and he feels that I should apologize to my panelists because today is the beginning of Champions League, where Juventus is playing Real Madrid. And in any other civilized country, my husband feels everything would defer to that. So I apologize on that score too. Now then, has a political climate or political events been something you felt aware of while you wrote, and do you feel that the climate seeped into or helped shape what you were writing, consciously or not? I'll go back to Aura. Politics.
Right.
This is probably a vocabulary challenge.
My words.
Oh, okay.
When I was writing, I was in this atmosphere in Mexico with a lot of violence and the drug traffic and everything in the government, the bad government. So, yeah, my first event, political event, was when I went to Chiapas and I met the Zapatistas, EZLN. So there I really knew the hunger and the pain and the rain of the Zapatistas, of the indígenas. So I always been a very activist, mm-hmm. With these issues because my mom is like that. So she took me in, I think my
your awareness is built into the writing.
Yeah, and the second one was more bigger. It was the camps, the civil resistance camps of López Obrador, mm-hmm. and I was 12 years old, and we spent 2 weeks sleeping on a table in doing these camps in the Zócalo of Mexico City. But for me, because I was very little, it was more like a game because I had new friends from everywhere. And
next to my door with the Oaxaca people. They had a little lion in the... I don't know. It was very... For me, it was wonderful, but unconsciously, I think that... that
it all seeped in.
Yeah.
It all soaked
unconsciously,
in.
Unconsciously, in a child mind, it is not like violence or there are not bad people. But I think it reflects in the book.
Yes.
Because it's a book about... Everybody think it's about immigration and the
yes
issues, bad issues. But no, it's about love and hope and how a kid can think about hopefully the life it's gonna be better. So it's about that.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Thank you. My team, Kosovo, Finland. Oh my!
Yeah, I mean, my family migrated to Finland when I was 2 years old from the former socialist Yugoslavia. And when I was writing this book, I'm going to be completely honest here and admit that I wasn't trying to make any political statements. I was just trying to write a novel about this. Mother and her son who grows up in Finland and meets this talking cat in a gay bar and and then goes to a relationship with the cat, even though the cat is very anti-immigrant and he feels drawn to the cat because of his, he feels that he's being othered by his nationality, so that's why he lets the cat say and do whatever the cat wants to do, and he ends up sleeping in the hallway of his own apartment. But what took me by surprise was that when the book was published, I was surprised by how it was read as a statement of something. Or I saw many news articles that said that the Finnish society is depicted in this and this way, and Albanians are like this and that, and it's like as a novelist and a writer of fiction, I don't think that I have the power to represent a nation or a country in any way. So that's why I don't know. And they sometimes the journalists even call me and ask me about immigration or what should we do with the situation in the Middle East, and I believe this a novel about immigration doesn't make me an expert of this subject, obviously, but then and if I had an answer to the biggest question of our lifetime, I would gladly tell the world.
And we would elect you. We would elect you something or other.
Yes.
Thank you, Paitim. Now, a writer starts with, in my estimation, the ones that work start with the micro, which becomes the macro. But very often, journalists and even innocent readers are hungry for a distillation and an interpretation. And I remember the American writer Elizabeth Strout wrote a very famous collection called Olive Kitteridge, which won the Pulitzer. And when someone asked her the derivation of olive, had she known olive, Strout said, "Oh, olive belongs to you now." And that's more or less what a writer gives. It belongs to you. Jonas, politics.
Yeah, I think I can say that politics and a certain kind of political thinking is always at the core of my writing. It's mostly, I take like a political problem or a political idea and start from there. Here it is, the financial crisis and the financial world. In my new book, it's about a certain relationship between the US, or especially between Silicon Valley and Germany, or old, what Donald Rumsfeld called old Europe. And it's a book about liberal thinking and libertarian thinking in the Silicon Valley, stuff like this. It's often my writing circles around politics and especially about economic politics.
It's delicious, I might add. I hope you all grab it today. And Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't write these stories with any kind of overt or explicit political position or any, you know, that I wanted to write about, but I just wrote about, you know,
The New York Times guy found an allusion to old Irish pounds in one of your stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Being a and comment that was, on economic humbuggery in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, there was just a practical reason why the old currency needed to be a plot point hinges on it essentially. A guy goes to rob a widow, and she's a lot of money upstairs, but it's all the old Irish currency that's no longer of any use.
Again, these are all fabulous books you guys have together.
But I mean, a lot of the reviewers kind of did talk about, you know, oh, this is a book about, you know, post-recession Ireland, and, you know, about this is about a small town and sort of marginal people there. And I mean, small towns get it either way; they're constantly on the verge of of extinction, like in times of economic prosperity, and sort of the Celtic Tiger era, as it was called, with the various financial bubbles that were expanding in the in the early, you know, the turn of the millennium in Ireland, and money was flying in from the EU and from investment overseas as well. People left small towns because there were better job prospects in the cities. And then, of course, when the bubble popped and everything went to shite, they went back home because they lost their jobs. But then they realized, I've got to go to Australia or somewhere in Canada to get a job because there's nothing here again. So it's, you know, small towns get it anyway. And that's all, you know, I was only writing about my own sort of experiences and the kind of people I knew. And I wanted to, you know, I think you can have a big idea or not, but I mean, I think you have to try to write with dignity about whatever your subject is, as you said, the micro level, and try and bring an integrity to it. And the ideas will be in it anyway. I think people, that's what readers are there for. They extrapolate things from it. And, you know, they do that work. If you're lucky, you have a receptive readership. So you don't have to worry.
No, not at all.
That'll be there.
And again, your micro led instantly to macro, a macro of hard bittenness, which I think is just everywhere in the very air of the story, that the stories breathe and that the characters breathe. Okay, the next question is for the other three who have come out in English translations. And it seems to me that translation is an art getting a lot of exciting attention now, and that Americans, literate Americans, are urging each other more powerfully to read more in translation. The writer Joel Agee, whom I idolize, the son of the late iconic James Agee, wrote an unforgettable, magnificent memoir called 12 Years, about growing up in the German Democratic Republic, in the East Germany, that the writer, the Jim Lardner, who is the great-grandson of Ring Lardner, said about 12 Years, it is so beautiful you can't own too many editions of it. Joel Agee has written a piece about translation in the latest issue of Agni magazine. It seems that the man he hired as a translator wasn't doing a very good job, and it freaked him out. He says, this man had sometimes translated what I had said, but hardly ever how I had said it. And in some cases, he had ignored what I had said and gone for what he presumed I had meant. Moreover, he seemed to have something against complex sentences. At one point, a single sentence of mine had turned into three in German. And so Joel Agee decides to translate himself, even though, he says, I had not written anything in German with the exception of a few letters since leaving Germany more than 20 years earlier. And what he concludes, after getting help from a friend of his mother's, who is German, and mowing through it word by word, was that there are three entities, the author, the writer, and the translator. The writer is the one who's getting it down. The author is the one who is owning it and proud of it and heir to it, and the translator is somewhere in between. The translator, meaning himself, taught the writer, meaning himself, something he didn't know yet. To write is to translate, not from another language, but from a formless, darkly stirring source where what needs to be said is felt to be potentially or even actually already present. And so the impossible work begins, gradually and sometimes in bursts. The translation into language takes shape, and when it is done, it seems like a miracle. Which I think is a beautiful description of translating oneself. So Jonas Aura and Paitim, did you work at all with your translators? And if not, what relationship did you have with them? And were you pleased with what you understood their product to be? Go ahead, Aura. Did you like your translator's product?
Yeah, well, I cannot read the book, but I think it's good, very good translator. Yeah, well, when the book came out 2 years ago, it was sold so quickly, so to so many languages. So with my translators, we did a Gmail group. Mm-hmm. Because in this book, the language is special because...
Oh, God, I should say this. Yes, Aura is the inventor of a most acrobatic, malleable, twisty-turny, self-invented language and diction that I've ever before seen. You have to read it to believe it. Words are created out of whole cloth that you never laid eyes on before, and yet you know perfectly well what they mean. This is in English, so I can only wonder how your translator managed that from Spanish to English.
Yeah. Well,
you just created one by one as you work together by email?
Yeah, we work together, and they ask me 1,000 of questions because they were like invented words. So
invented.
Neither yes. I had the answer, so by mimic, I tried to tell the translators what was in my mind in this specific word. So I don't like to say that they are translators. They are co-authors, because they needed to invent their own words in their own language. So I never will know if the translator is good or bad, or because I don't know the languages. So
you can trust me, they're good.
Yeah.
Yours is good.
Yeah. And they are words from your grandma's times or words that you don't hear anymore, and that's why that's how we did it, and it was a magnificent email because there are like 72 emails. I don't know. It was a year for work, and also the translators speaks another language, so they ask each other like, how do you do this, and can you give me your Italian version and I can see my English version. But with the English translator, I wrote in Spanish, but it calls Inglignol. I don't know, it's not Spanglish, it's Inglignol, because the Spanish is more powerful in the novel. But I had a few phrases in English, but they are just the basic of English, because it's a boy who crossed the border, so we needed to do this in Spanglish. And for the English version, the translator did The reverse, yeah. She put a little words in Spanish, and
it works.
It
works.
I don't know.
I will just vouch for it right here. Thank you. Okay, Paitim, for translation.
I'm happy with the translation. And
did you work with that person?
I did. He lives in like a couple of blocks from me in Helsinki.
How handy.
And it was really like we worked together on some sections that were more difficult, and because I have quite many Albanian words, and we did that. But then when we were working with the publisher here, I because English is not my the language I write in, so I felt like I wasn't that helpful in the whole process, but it worked well. It's really a lot easier for me to be reading my own work in another language than in Finnish.
It's easier?
Because when I'm done with my stuff, I really just want to leave it behind, because I always want to edit out, like, I'm getting, like, mad to my editor and, like, why did you let me publish this section? It's
wow.
So in this way I can, because I didn't produce the translation, so it's easier for me to read it and pretend that it's not me, it's the translator.
Okay, that's good. Handy. And Jonas?
Yeah, actually, with my British translator, I had quite a lot of discussions, probably also because it's the only language, maybe also French, I can really read and can say something about it. And I made experience that always when I talk with people who translate my stuff into English, that I have to fight for my long sentences. I have really long sentences. Especially my new book, there are more than 3 pages, just one sentence.
Whoa.
And English translators tend to say it's not possible in English, which is just not true. I always say, what's with Henry James? People like this. I think the long sentence just got lost in the English language.
It did.
They are there.
We have a terrible attention span.
Yeah. And I was very lucky because the Pol Vecja, which is kind of the Swiss governmental culture foundation, they paid for a workshop with 5 of my translators. So wow. I could invite 5 of them into the Swiss mountains in a small village for 4 days. And we were there 4 days together, and we read the complete book together, sentence for sentence, and discussed it. And there was somebody there who wrote the protocol of it. It's like a 40, 50 page protocol, and each new translator gets this protocol where every single sentence which is difficult is discussed. That's really fantastic.
Wow.
And it was, for me, it was a very interesting experience, because I learned a lot about my own writing, because translators are scary readers, because they are really the most precise readers.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask you all these questions about things you do normally just by intuition, but they want to know why you did it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very much aware about your own tools you use as a writer. So I probably learned really a lot in these 4 days.
Wow.
About my writing.
That's astonishing and humbling. Whew. Okay, did you have translation experience yet? Not yet.
No, it's been, yeah. No, it's
yes?
been translated.
Did you have to work with someone?
Yeah, I mean, it's been translated into maybe...
Oh, sorry.
Eight or 9 languages.
My mistake.
Oh, don't worry about that, John.
Did people crawl all over you to get it right?
Well, there's loads of Irish, like, there's loads of slang in it.
Yeah.
And Irish English, or Hiberno English, whatever you want to call it, the sort of the way Irish people use the English language and the cadences we use is very different. So that always kind of presented, you know, most of the translators would get in touch and kind of trying to figure out what the hell a slang phrase meant.
Was that amusing or exhausting? Or
sometimes it was amusing, you know, because they would make a sincere go at trying to work out like a guard, a policeman is referred to as a pig, and they, you know, the Dutch translator, very lovely man, sent me like 2 paragraphs of his wrong attempt to figure out how the guy resembled a pig.
Oh,
but there was loads of things, and I mean, I don't speak any other languages. You know, they do fantastic work. Most of the translators were incredibly open, and they would come to you and ask you something, and then they'd explain if they were going to change something or kind of come up with an equivalent phrase or meaning rather than a transliterated one, and they'd explain it why. So, you know, they're just, my experience with them is they're all very, very generous. And the only kind of anomalous one is the French translation came out a year or so ago, and the translator just never got in touch. They just did it, just translated it. And but apparently they translate a lot of Irish writing into French, so they kind of they're able to handle apparently the slang and all that stuff. So they just did it. So
maybe I should challenge myself to read the French version.
Yeah. So.
Okay, I'm going to go straight to my last question because I think Aura has to leave us a little bit early and I want to save time for audience questions. And my last question brings us back to the beginning of things since this is officially a panel about beginnings. And my question is, what would you tell your starting out self? And also, what would you tell someone else starting out? If you can just off the top of your head... think about this. For myself, I've been at it more years than I'm willing to tell you all right now. And I think if I were to talk to my beginning self, I would say, get very strong. Get strong externally as you can. Let the inside be molten lava or quivering tapioca, but get very, very strong externally because you're going to have to... withstand a lot of slings and arrows, and you're going to have to wait a long time for things to pop. And I wouldn't want to scare myself further, my young self further, with details. What would you guys say to yourselves when you began, although you're already still so very young? Aura, what would you tell the 16-year-old Aura? Besides, you know, don't drink so much cola.
I am not sure. I will tell my 16-year-old self. Study a lot.
That's good. And what would you tell someone here who is starting? Advice for writing.
If you have kids, don't force them to read because they will hate the literature. So you need to buy it books that they want. And everything that you You need to write everything that passes in your mind, even the from the dreams. We had a lot of good story for the dreams. And one advice is, if you don't remember your dreams, you can put your clock 1 hour before you wake up, and then you only need to.
Wake up and write it down.
No, up and you turn off the clock. You get to sleep, and you will remember this hour from sleeping and from dreams. Uh-huh. I do that.
Okay,
it is.
You may be closely questioned about this later. thank you, Pai Ting. What you would tell yourself and what you would tell these guys?
I would tell myself maybe that don't worry so much, because I was 24 when this book was out and I was really scared for like publishing it because of its themes and subjects, and I would continue on saying to people who aspire to become writers that to the same, because it's not that serious in the end, and we're eventually all gonna die one day, and our books will be buried. So.
This is wonderful. This is wonderful. I'm so, so happy today to hear you guys. And Jonas?
I would maybe say just try to focus on writing the best book you can, and don't think about publishing. Don't think about the reader, just think about writing a good book.
Would you tell yourself that and these people?
Yeah.
That makes sense. That's good. I like it. My friend?
It would be something similar. I mean, I don't think you can tell. You can try and tell a young person, you know, calm down, you know, it's not a young person's game. You can be published at any point in your life and you'll probably never regret being made to wait a few years. You know, you're never going to go, I wish that book had been published like earlier or whatever. Really, you know, when you look back. And, you know, so yeah, just take your time and don't try and like force weird ultimatums on your life that you have to be published by a certain age or, you know, setting yourself up to fail, because it's, you know, it's, that doesn't help the writing. And I if someone told me that when I was 21, I would have, you know, just whatever.
That's perfect.
So, you know, you can't, you,
that's perfect.
You can't tell them, John. You can't tell them.
I couldn't agree more with every single comment of each of these wonderful writers. If you would like to ask questions, now is the time. And my thought is, shout it out as best you can, and I'll repeat it into the mic for anyone who can't hear me. Oh, I see. There's a mic that can float to you. Okay, so let her rip. And you can ask all of them, or singularly, or...
Hi, could each of you or a couple of you mention how you decided on the central character and like if it, that person had anything to do with your own experiences, how you objectified what those characters' characteristics are?
Okay, you'll have to do this in brief, friends, as best you can, briefly, very briefly. Whomever would like, go for it. Central character objectified. Anybody?
I wrote short stories, so they each had different central characters. But the thing about mine was the setting, and as I said, setting it in this small town just sort of seemed to unlock something in my writing, and in terms of subject matter, and all these characters just sort of poured out. You know, once I fixed in my head that I was writing about a particular place, so it came out of place. And there's lots of, you know, and many of my favorite writers are regional writers or so-called Flannery O'Connor, Faulkner, people like this, and you know, who you know, there's a whole society they're writing about, but they're writing about the world, they're writing about everything, and it can be contained in a small town setting, or you know, these, you know. So that's what unlocked it for me. I spent years writing fruitlessly, trying to write like only with my head. I was trying to impose ideas, you know, fabulate these sort of bizarre, over elaborate books full of characters I didn't know and didn't recognize. Because I thought, like a lot of people do, my own life experience is pretty nondescript or not worthy of whatever. But what happens is you find genius writers like Flannery O'Connor or whoever, and you see them writing about these things that somehow resonate with you, and you realize, you know, the stuff of your own life, however ostensibly innocuous it is, can be written about, you know, seriously, in terms of not solemnly, but you can write about it and you can put all of human life into it. So as I said, I had different characters, but they were all set. They come roughly from the same kind of socioeconomic background. They have, you know, they're mostly young men in the thing. But it was that way of setting, you know, and then that just unlocked it for me, you know. So often what happens is you're completely trying to work out one thing, which is your main character or something, but the key is some other facet of it, the setting, you know. So that's how writing often seems to work anyway. The same with arriving at a plot.
That's good.
You're working on something else, and then the plot comes.
That's good. Other questions, so we can spread it around.
Well, it was interesting when Colin talked about stumbling into his publisher, and I'm wondering if the other three would be possibly talk about the transition from when you thought, "I've got this book here," to, you know, getting the relationship with the publisher and finding somebody to really say, okay, I'm going to do it.
Okay, very briefly.
Yeah. I sent my pages to a contest. It was a national contest, and the book won the prize. So the prize was the publishing the book. So that's why I start in this publishing houses, and because I didn't know nothing about it.
but that's why.
Right. That's very often the case, by the way, is a young writer or an old writer will win a contest, and that will usher the book into the world. Pai Ting.
Yeah, I sent my manuscript when I worked on it for almost 2 years, and when I didn't know what to do with the manuscript anymore, how to edit it, I just sent it out to all the publishers in Finland, and then they called me the next afternoon for Ooh. One. So now, yeah.
That's fantastic. I'm not surprised, though, but it's lovely.
When sometimes you're sending a manuscript out to an agent or a magazine or a publisher, and they go, no multiple submissions, i.e., if you send it to us, don't send it to anyone else. Just ignore that. Just do it. Just send it to everybody.
I agree. I totally,
send it to everybody.
Totally agree. Yeah. Jonas.
I worked for my first novel, the one I never published, together with an agent who wasn't able to sell it. But then the second book, Barbarian Spring, he had a couple of offers.
So you kept him even though he couldn't sell the first one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That was good. That was an act of faith.
Yeah, he actually was kind of a really, really good agent. Sadly, he died
oh,
by
I'm
now,
sorry.
But he was
sorry.
Kind of like the most famous agent in Germany.
Oh,
everybody was
goodness.
Like, he's the good guy in the business. So
that's,
I was very happy with him. And then I had a couple of offers, and I just had to decide which one I take, which I think is something, it's a difficult choice then, and what I try to do is not thinking about what they offer money-wise, but what kind of publishing house it is. And I decided to go to CH Beck, which is kind of one of the oldest publishing houses in Germany. It's 254 years old and still family-owned in the ninth generation, and not one of these huge companies like Bertelsmann or whatever you have in all the countries.
Wonderful.
And that's something I enjoy, to have this family-owned business, and you have the stability, and the publishing house will not be sold or
right.
like this. Yeah,
right. It's an unstable industry. And Colin, you sent it.
It was true. A contemporary short story magazine, as this
that's right.
The Sting of Fly. But that was totally it. That was my way in. It was
because
I love short stories. But I mean, and this again is like early 2000s. I didn't know that anyone still published short stories. I thought it seems like they stopped being published about 40 years before I was born. But that so it was vital that this magazine was going, and Declan nurtured it. And there's a pretty good indigenous publishing scene in Ireland now. There's a drive on from the national publishers to try and find new voices, which is great.
Good.
So that was it. Yeah, magazine. He took me, sent in a story. He read it, the submissions, and
so that was Stinging Fly.
Yeah.
And then they sold it to Black Cat. I see this is Black Cat.
Yeah, and it got sold in the UK and everywhere else, but
right.
it was the several years with Declan, just working with me.
Fabulous. These are glorious golden success stories. Other questions?
Oh, thank you. I'm curious, over the arc of your work, from first sitting down to write to the point of publication, what was the most challenging step for you?
Whomever. Whatever.
Que te paguen.
Say what?
Que...
The most challenging?
That the publishing house need to pay you.
Ah.
I think that's a challenge. I don't know.
Anybody else?
I think it's very challenging every morning to go to the computer and read what I have written the last day.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge every day.
Mm-hmm. That's fair, I think. From writing to publication, sure. This person?
My question was very similar. I was going to ask, what are some of your personal writing weaknesses and your strategies for overcoming them?
Anybody want to jump in? Let's see. Mine is to want to avoid it entirely.
Yeah.
And the way I overcome that is by having several colors of paint on the palette, meaning several projects going. And so whatever I want to avoid, I jump to another thing. And I promise myself I won't make myself suffer. I'll keep myself in delight. And then eventually you wander back to the thing you were avoiding because nobody's holding a gun to your head. But the main thing is to get rid of that performance anxiety, guilt, judgment, doom, and, you know, negative radio station noise that comes at you. And to tell yourself this is yours, you own it, you're alone with it, and it's you can do whatever you want. You can make a big mess. And I hope I...
I have a program on my computer called self-control that shuts down the internet and emails for several hours.
Oh.
That helps. I can really recommend it.
Bravo.
Self-control.
For me...
Yeah.
For me, I think it's tolerating the writer's block when you have it because it can last for months. Mm. And usually I don't write every day. I usually wait for the right moment or for inspiration to hit me in some way because I don't want writing fiction to feel like a burden, or I don't want it to feel like a chore, or that I'm forced to sit down and write something because I love it too much for it to feel like that. Mm-hmm. So and then if it goes on and goes on, and then you start questioning like your writing abilities, and that will it ever come back to you again, and will you ever feel that joy in writing again? And but it always comes back eventually after some time.
I think you train yourself to have that faith.
Yeah.
It's about time, I think, to wrap. So before you all go, I want to thank everyone again. I want to thank these fabulous writers. I'm not going to ask them what's next because I'm going to assume that there will be a next and that we will all gobble what is next of theirs, however long it takes or short. And I encourage you all, please, to come sign, have them sign your books and ask them anything you like at that time as well. I'll be out there signing, too. Thank you so much for helping us do this.
And thank you all so much.
Thank you, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.